Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. This is the Best of 2023 Clip Show Part 2, where you can hear from a selection of our wonderful guests that we've had during 2023. We're going to play some of the best clips, some of the clips that we've enjoyed hearing from some of our wonderful guests that we've had. If you're not familiar with the show, you probably are, but if you're not, then I asked my guests to pick the 5 video games they would like to install on their very own fictional games machine. And then we talk about their life and their career in amongst that and whatever else seems relevant. So in the last 12 months, we've had a selection of people from the video games industry, people who make games. We've also had people who just play games from other industries, actors, comedians, musicians, all sorts of different kinds of people. We're going to hear from some of them in this episode today. One of the great things that we've been able to do is to invite some people from the earlier days of the video game industry onto the show and hear their memories about what it was like working at some of the best loved and best known companies working in video games. In this first section, we're going to hear from Henk Rogers, the man who discovered Tetris, or who at very least brought Tetris to the masses by selling it to Nintendo and publishing it on the Game Boy as was made. A story that was dramatized by Apple in the Tetris movie out earlier this year. Henk, in the clip that you're going to hear, is describing the time when he met Hiroshi Yamauchi, the president of Nintendo at the time, a very intimidating figure. This is in the late 1980s, early 1990s. Then we're going to hear from Dylan Cuthbert, who also, when he was just a teenager in the, I think, the early 90s, visited Nintendo's HQ in Kyoto. And we're going to hear from some of the famous people he met there, even though he didn't really recognize them at the time. Then we're going to hear from Charles Cecil, the co-founder of Revolution Software, creators of Broken Sword. Charles is talking about when he worked at the video game publisher Activision in the 1980s and some of the things they got up to. Then we're going to hear from Jörg Tittel, who brought out the brilliant Cosmic Smash versus, or C Smash VRS, a sequel to the Dreamcast classic earlier in 2023. And from Jörg, we're going to be hearing about his time working on the video game adaptation of the Steven Spielberg movie Minority Report, a game he was also working on for Activision, and some of his memories of that time. Sit back, enjoy these clips, and I'll be back in a minute with some more. How did you come to meet Nintendo's president, Hiroshi Yamauchi, at that time?
My wife read an article in a magazine that said that Mr. Yamauchi plays Go. Wow, I play Go. My father plays Go. And somebody had submitted a game from England. I forget the name of the original game, but it was for the Commodore 64. It was a Go game, 9x9, tiny Go. It actually played Go. I mean, for a computer at that time to actually play Go was a miracle, let alone an 8-bit computer, let alone a 6502-based computer, because the Apple, Commodore, and the Nintendo machine all had the same CPU, the 6502, which meant that the algorithm for running the Go game I could just translate that algorithm bit for bit and not have to rewrite any code for that. So I sent Mr. Yamauchi a fax. My name is Hank Rogers. I can make a Go game for your Nintendo machine. I'm leaving for the States on Saturday. I would like to see you before I go. I didn't say I lived in Japan. That was Tuesday. And on Wednesday, I got a fax back from his assistant. Mr. Yamauchi will see you tomorrow.
Yikes.
It was like, whoa. that was so fast. And so I bullet trained it from Yokohama to Kyoto. I'm in my first meeting with Mr. Yamauchi. He goes, I can't give you any programmers. I said, I don't need programmers. I just need money. This is my first meeting in Japanese, by the way. Up till then, I'd had an interpreter.
Right.
And I came to the realization that my interpreter wasn't saying what I was saying.
Right, yeah.
And I would rather have broken Japanese where I'm actually saying it rather than my interpreter. So anyway.
I wonder what they would have translated you asking for money. They would have said something else.
I don't need programmers. They just need money. And he goes, how much? Yeah. And then, oh my God, I hadn't even thought about this at all at the moment. So I had to think of a number. And I thought the biggest number I could think of at the time, which was $300,000. So I said, $300,000. Yeah. And he reached across the table and shook my hand.
Wow.
It's that fast. I was like, holy shit, now what do I have to do? I don't know what to do. So, okay, thank you very much. I hadn't even contacted the programmer in England. His name was Alan Scarf. Alan Scarf. I remember he lived in Reading. So I contacted.
So you had to call this guy up and say, we haven't met, but I've just sold your game to Nintendo.
Yeah, something like that.
We flew over. It was just like, you know, what is this place? It was just so different.
Yeah.
So they're like, yeah, vending machines everywhere. That was the biggest impression I got as soon as I got off the plane.
And did you meet them in, you went to Kyoto, but did you land in Kyoto?
We landed in Osaka.
Okay.
We landed in Osaka, yeah. So we got a taxi from the airport to Kyoto. I just remember looking out the window, it's dark, and just seeing all the vending machines go by. And just like, this is weird. This is like surreal. All these vending machines. What do they do with all these vending machines? And we went to the hotel. And Miyamoto Izushi, who is one of the guys who worked with Yokoi on the Game Boy, met us in the lobby with the Nintendo America guys. They're like, I think it's one or maybe two people from there as well. And we all met in the lobby and had a quick evening drink, I think. I think we were all tired. So we just kind of met, had a drink, had a chat. I got introduced to Miyamoto and Izushi at that point. And I didn't know who they were. So it's just... Miyamoto is very young at the time. He's like, he told me, I remember very clearly because I asked him, so how old are you? I was like, very, you know, he doesn't normally call me, ask me how old people are. But, and he said 38. And I was like, my mind was blown because there's like no one, there's no one beyond 30 in the games industry in the UK. Everyone was like under 25.
Right.
I'd never met anybody that old before. It was so weird. It was just so weird having, you know, meeting someone that old in the games industry. Like, it just didn't make it, like, you know, I thought it was all just young kids right. until then, you know.
I hope you didn't have that reaction towards him when he told you his age.
Yeah, I can't remember, actually. I probably did. So, oh God, you're so old.
You mentioned Gunpei Yokoi, who the designer of the Game Boy. Was he? Did you get to meet him on that trip? I know you worked on his team a bit later, but did you meet him?
Yeah, we met him the next day. He was one of the guys who came in the meeting, Yokoi, and also a few other people as well. I mean, there's about 20 of them, I think, came in. I can't remember the exact number, but there's a lot of people came into that meeting.
Yes.
But that was when I first met Yokoi as well. Actually, he's the guy. He went out and summoned Sakamoto as well into the meeting.
Right.
Because probably he was thinking, oh, maybe you can make a 3D Metroid or something. I don't know.
Right.
Sakamoto was underneath Yokoi. Mm-hmm. He was in that group.
I see.
Miyamoto was in a different group. So Miyamoto was in a group run by a guy called Fukui, who is more like a business manager type guy. And they still, it's interesting, when I was talking to Sakamoto, like, you know, a year or two ago, and he said that in his entire career at Nintendo, he's never ever worked with Miyamoto because they're always separate.
Kept them separately.
So they're always in separate groups,
right?
You know, completely separate groups. So they never ever had any crossover. You know, they've always known each other, always been friendly, but they just,
of course.
And I thought it's just so interesting, you know.
Like,
two designers that never worked with each other.
They're so valuable to Nintendo that the company has to keep them apart just in case. There's
maybe they implode or something. You know?
Yeah. what did they want from you? You know, they brought you out here presumably because you've been doing amazing 3D things with the Game Boy.
Yeah.
You know, how soon was it until they said, do you want to just work here?
Yeah.
And stay here at least.
In that meeting, that first meeting, they said they wanted 3D. They wanted to learn how to do 3D and they had no idea how to do it. And they knew how to draw it. So they showed us pilot wings, and they showed an aircraft, the biplane that they'd created. And they said, Miyamoto said he had to draw, you know, not personally, but someone had to draw this, all the frames of the rotation, and they couldn't do all the rotations because it was just too many frames and too much graphics memory. And so he said, how can we do this in 3D? Because it'll save us all this work, you know. It's just draw this in 3D. Argonaut had been working with a console maker called Konix that ended up not making a console, and it was called the Konix Multisystem. And I'd been programming on that as well before doing the Game Boy demo, and it had all gone under. Like, you know, the Konix, they made really good joysticks. I mean, maybe they're still around even, but at the time they made really good joysticks. And they tried to do this console without, before realizing how much it would cost them or something. I'm not sure, but there was something that fell apart in the funding side, and it all just disappeared. But it had custom chips in it, and because we were quite involved in these titles, we knew the people who had designed these chips, you know, and they were sort of ex Sinclair engineers, and there was a company called Flair, basically, who made these chips. And Jez basically just called up a couple of these guys who he knew, you know, were now out in the wild and looking for, you know, chip related work. He basically called them up from that meeting, you know, directly from the meeting room with Nintendo. And said, okay, we've got this cartridge, because we'd never seen the Super Nintendo before, right? So this is a prototype they'd shown us. And we basically asked them for all the spec of the cartridge and all the pins on the cartridge. And I said, all right, this is the pin spec. What do you reckon? Can we get this chip into the cartridge? You know, can we get some sort of 3D booster or something in there? What do you reckon? And they basically discussed it and decided right then that they could do something. And then with like balls of steel, Jez went and talked to Yamauchi. I wasn't in that meeting because Yamauchi's quite a fierce
He was this president of Nintendo at the time.
And the sort of founder and everything, right? And he and Jez said, oh, we can do it for this amount of money. And he said some number that he thought was really high, and Yamauchi said, all right, let's do it then. Because for him, the number was really low.
Right. And this is the...
So they're probably going to ask for a lot more money.
Yeah, and that's what turned out to be the Super FX chip that gave 3D effects to Super Nintendo games.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We will get to your second game in a minute, but just quickly, I think people would be interested to hear what Activision was like at that time. Was it, I mean, I assume it was very different to the Activision of today.
It was a very different Activision, yes. It was very tough in many ways. My manager in the US simply didn't care that there was an 8-hour time difference. So he'd phone me up midnight and right. expect me to get back to him. And more broadly, I did. But I was young. Many nights, I would sit all night with the developers and have a snooze in my chair, which was crunch and is extraordinarily counterproductive. And so I'm not, you know, in any way endorsing it, but it's what we did.
Yeah, it's so the picture you paint is so 1980s. I have to say,
I know. Yeah, well, actually, I'm telling you, the guy I'm talking about is called Jeff Mulligan. And he was my Uber boss. He was my boss's boss. I remember I'd been at Activision for about 6 months, and he phoned me up and he said, look, Chuck, because he'd call me Chuck Cecil. He said, Chuck, I think you need to come out to San Francisco. I go, okay, Jeff, yeah, no. And so I went over and I was, you know, he'd given me such a hard time, but, you know, that was par for the course. And I arrived on the Wednesday, and we did some work on Wednesday and Thursday. And then I turned up on Friday morning. He went, Chuck, we're going out on the boat. And I said, but Jeff, we've got all this work to do. But Friday, boat day. He had what's called a cigarette boat. It was basically a drug smuggler boat, powered with 2 5-liter engines. It went so fast. And we went out. And I remember going in this boat at maybe about 120 miles an hour and hitting the wake of the Alcatraz ferry and going up and going back down, and everybody was cheering. And in the evening, after a few hours, we chugged into this wonderful place where they served us tequila top cocktails. And I was going, this is what he does every day. He gives me a hard time, but actually he's out on his boat all the time. He came over to London, I remember, when we were based in Reading. And I was rowing, and I still row. And he went, Chuck, yeah, I gather you row. He said, I'd like to challenge you to a rowing race. I went, okay. A few months go by, and I go, Jeff, what about this rowing race? He go, okay. So he got the whole company to my club, which was in Hammersmith. And he got into a boat, and I got into a boat. He claimed that his boat had got lost stuck in customs or something. I don't remember. Anyway, so, and the Thames is flowing really, really fast.
Is this a proper skull boat?
Yes, this is a proper skull boat. Exactly, yes. So the Thames is running really fast. My boss is Rod Cousins. His boss is Jeff Mulligan. So he's my Uber boss. And I'm going, God, this is... So we get into the skull, and the CFO, who's been brought along from America, shouts, go, we go. He turns straight over. He thinks because he can... He's good on a skull, you know, on an ergo, that he can skull, and all hell breaks loose because the water's going really fast and he's being dragged towards the hull of a boat. And if he goes between those hulls moored together, he's going to drown.
Oh, gosh.
So he is utterly humiliated. He's pulled out and he looks at me and he goes, right, we'll do the rowing machine. Okay, Jeff. Like, okay. So I go first and, you know, I'm pretty fit, and I do a 2,000 meters. I do it in however many, you know, seven and a half minutes or whatever. And he goes on there, you know, he's cut his foot, so there's a bit of blood coming out, and off he goes. And he's like sort of bat out of hell for the first minute, and then he slows down, and then he goes paler and paler and paler until he's completely white except for the blood oozing out of his foot, and he's way 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 behind me. And it's like, this is not the way to go forward of the American company. This is not what you do.
No. Shaking his fist at you, damn you, Chuck Cecil.
Exactly. He stood up and he had to be held up because otherwise he would have fainted. Oh,
oh God. Wow.
I don't know why okay. I do it. I don't know why I do it.
So that's how you came to leave Activision.
Exactly. That is how I came to leave Activision.
And I said, but how about, okay, no, I'm sorry, but I won't do that. And he's like, oh, like this. And I said, yeah, because I don't think that I should be doing that. I think, how about I sit down with a really skilled young programmer and design a tool that would allow idiots like myself to build levels and therefore be able to focus on what we know how to do well, which is sort of writing characters and things, which I feel games could really use at this stage, right? Especially one based on a Steven Spielberg movie. It's like, oh, okay. And so I thought I'd completely messed it up. And then they offered me a job.
Nice.
Which is great. but we had absolutely no right. access to the
to game. The film.
To the film. They gave us no access to the film. I was told by the producer, one of the producers there, he said, like, well, I've read the script and I can walk you through it. And I'm like, yeah, it's like, yeah, it's a high security situation. You know, it's we're under multiple NDAs. You know, we cannot, you know, the junior team members cannot read it and all that stuff. And I had my sort of 2 or 3 month sort of review meeting at Activision HQ, just like within like stone's throw of Bobby the Hutt Kotick's office.
Don't say anything libelous.
Did I say anything?
Not yet.
Okay. And I was in a meeting with a producer at Activision. So he's like, you know, the boss of the Treyarch producer, essentially.
Yeah.
And he's so how is it going? You know, how is your experience here so far? We've had some positive feedback on your performance and all that jazz. And I go, it's great. I don't know how my performance could be positive because I have no idea what the film is about. You know, I've been given this thing. I have no idea. I mean, it seems like we're doing something that goes counter to what the film is about. Yeah, well, that's because we can't use Tom Cruise's likeness. That's not part of the license agreement.
It's like a comedy, isn't it? It's like if you were writing, I mean, it's like a script for something where you go, awful. This is too far-fetched.
It was awful. And you know how the film was about predicting violence and murder, and you had these precogs characters, and they could... And they were tied into some cables and computers, and like you couldn't even commit a crime because they would predict your crime ahead of you doing it. You get arrested ahead of time and whatever. So what did Treyarch decide to make? What kind of game did they decide to make? Is a brawler where you walk around and throw people out of windows, and you go like,
yeah,
hang on a second, and say, yeah, just ride around that. So I don't know, they've turned off the precog department or something temporarily, and so I'm like, but that's not the point of the whole thing. We're missing a whole point. This is bullshit. Like, so anyway, but that's what we're doing, they said. Okay. Anyway, I was in that meeting, and at some point, he was actually called into Mr. Kotick's office. Mm. And so during that time, I looked at the little sort of Filofax with all the phone numbers, and I called up the production office of the film. I did.
No, you didn't.
And I said,
well, like Amblin.
It was at Fox, I believe, or whatever the studio was.
Oh, Fox. Okay. Yeah.
And I said, excuse me. Hi. I'm calling you here from Activision, and I'm technically a writer on a junior writer on this on the game on the Minority Report game. And they go like, "There's a game?" I was like, "Yeah. There's. I guess this is probably something that went straight only through your marketing department, but we're working on a game, and some of us are really passionate about making a really good game, and I'd love to do that myself. The problem is I haven't read the script, so do you think I could read the script? Oh yeah, sure. Just where are you right now? Activision headquarters, is that just the address? What's your name? Great, cool. We'll send you a copy right away. And I'm like, really? Yeah, sure. Okay. So the meeting continues. He comes back, you know, he sits down, whatever, and literally within 20 minutes, this guy in a motorcycle helmet comes in and goes like, "Mr. Tittle!" And this courier hands me this, and the producer goes like, "What is this?" I'm like, "Oh, that's the script. The script to the movie." And I say, "What do you mean? What movie? What Minority Report? I just asked for it. Don't worry, it's cool. Like they're totally cool with it." So that didn't put me in the greatest stead, unfortunately, with most people.
Well, with the middle management, I guess, we're pretty cross that you cut out their jobs there.
The games industry has changed a lot in its 40-odd year history. In this next clip, we're going to hear from Eddie Gibson, former games journalist and now sort of jet-setting comedian as part of the duo Scummy Mummies. Eddie's recording the time when she went for an interview to work at Sony PlayStation. This is in the early days of PlayStation 2. And she had a rather normal job interview until a rather strange bit at the end before they told her that, in fact, she did have the job. Thankfully, I think things are a little different these days.
And anyway, I'd worked at the telly company for a bit, and then that ended. And then again, I was just unemployed and I didn't know what to do. And I saw an advert in the newspaper for a copywriter at PlayStation. And I didn't even know what a copywriter was. But I was like, oh, that's, you know, PlayStation, brilliant. So I applied for it. So did over 300 other people. But miraculously, I got the job.
Do you remember the interview, what they asked you?
There was a three-stage interview. There was a sort of meet. Just a normal interview, and then I think there was another chat. I had to do weird stuff, like I had to write some plot ideas for Brookside.
What?
Yeah, I had to write like 3 pages of plot lines for Brookside. After I got the job, I said, what was that about? And the guy was like, well, I wanted to make sure that you could turn your hand to any kind of writing, because you have to write about different kinds of games, and I'm just a really big fan of Brookside.
Maybe they were like hoping to like pitch some move into script writing, they just wanted to take your ideas or something.
Yeah, it was all odd.
So strange.
But then the final sort of interview, they said, we want you to come in one more time. They said, it's down to you and one other person. Come into the office in Golden Square. So I came in and they sat me down in this little room with a PlayStation 2. And the PlayStation 2 wasn't even out yet. So as a gamer, this was like
pretty cool.
Willy Wonka giving you an everlasting gobstopper. I was just like, what? And they were like, we're just going to leave you here for a few minutes. And I've just got to go and check something. I'll be right back. I was like, and they were like, just play the game. Just have a play. Just see how you feel. It was Sky Odyssey, the playing game. And I picked up the controller and I started playing it and loved it. And it was awesome. And then after about 10 minutes, they came back in and they went, oh, hi, how are you getting on? And I was like, yeah, brilliant. I'm just doing this bit. And they were like, oh, cool, you've got the job. And I was like, oh, I thought you had to check. And they were like, no. I said, I thought there was another candidate. And they were like, no, you've got the job. That's all fine. It was odd, but I was just really happy and pleased. And it wasn't until months later that I was at a party and a drunk person said to me, we wanted to check that you really weren't bluffing us and that you really knew your way around a PlayStation.
No.
Because, and that he actually said, because you're a girl, we wanted to make sure that you weren't,
oh my,
you know,
goodness.
It wasn't all just sort of a big bluff.
So it's like a two-way mirror that they're all stood behind to see what you do.
See if I still put the controller in my bra. I don't know. Accidentally put it in my vagina because I don't know what they thought I was going to do. Yeah. And when they told me, you know, I was 23 and it's different. It was a different time. And I just sort of went, oh, that's so funny. Oh, cool. I'm glad I passed that test. And now, of course, I look back on it and go, ooh, how fucking dare you?
Of course. Yeah, that's scandalous.
But, you know, it is what it is.
Oh my gosh. Sometimes when we're growing up, a video game can arrive in our lives at a particular moment where it just leaves an indelible mark. Perhaps that can be because it's attached to some special memories around playing the game. That's certainly the case for my next two guests. Danny Pudi, who you'll know as playing the actor who plays the character Abed in the brilliant Community TV show. In this clip, he remembers the time when his mother, who worked for a video game or arcade game maker, managed to secure a Mortal Kombat 2 arcade cabinet and told Danny and his brother that she'd installed it in their garage. And then, relevantly, we're going to hear from Joseph McAtish, the editor of Time Out in London. Joseph, when he was a young person, recalls here going on a play date with his younger brother and his younger brothers, one of his friends from school, Louis Amis. That's the son of the novelist Martin Amis. And Martin Amis, who sadly died earlier in 2023, came to Joe's house and picked him and his brother up and took them, I think, to the local ice rink, where Joe, as a 10-year-old or something, stood and watched the other children playing Mortal Kombat 2 while standing next to the great novelist himself.
My mom actually worked in the video game industry for many years.
Really?
So my mother worked for Williams Bally Midway.
No way.
And it was a company that made a lot of games, pinball games, arcade games, and she worked in their information systems department in Chicago back in the day. And there were some nights where there were issues with the server or tech issues. And I remember her having to take me to work with her while she was figuring out a problem with engineers. And sometimes that would feel like, this is a this is going to be really boring, but I always kind of looked forward to it because in the basement of her work were all these games.
No way.
And and so I got to go there all the time. And Mortal Kombat was one of those games, Mortal Kombat 2. And we eventually were given one of these games, Mortal Kombat 2. My mom bought it. I don't remember how it worked out. But
she just went down to the basement.
Yeah, I came into my garage and my house, and we had Mortal Kombat 2 sitting there. That was in high school, and, you know, you immediately have friends.
Did you kind of announce that at school then the next day? Hey, guess what I've got at my place?
I didn't want to because I was like, I don't know. You know, I don't want to have a line. I don't want to have this, like, you know, speakeasy style arcade in the back of my garage in Chicago. But it was cool. Me and my buddies used to love it. My brother and his friends, and we'd all gather in the garage after school and play Mortal Kombat 2. And, you know, discovering the fatalities was another incredible layer of that game because I've never seen anything like that. And I remember just being so shocked.
Right, right.
I don't remember exactly which one was the one where you turn into a baby. I think you could turn your opponent into a baby. There was the level of surprises in that game, you know?
Yeah. Do you think your mom knew about the fatalities when she bought it for you?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. If she knew that we were in the garage, like pulling like spinal cords out of our opponents or, yeah, you know, burning them or, you know, pulling out their hearts. I mean, with Raiden, you're just like electrocuting your opponents. It was incredibly violent. But again, for 16, 17 year old me, oh boy, that was fun with my buddies.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
This is quite a weird detail to remember, but I remember it was such a hot commodity. There was a magazine that put a trailer or a teaser, a preview about Mortal Kombat 2 or 3 on the cover, but they didn't have any imagery that related to it. But that didn't stop them from doing a Mortal Kombat 3 cover that I think was just like a sort of stick drawing of someone's head falling off or something like that. And I mean, they must have just thought, put this thing on the cover. It's a license to print money.
Right, right.
And I believe it was. It was probably responsible for people flying back to arcades as well.
Yeah.
People just desperate to show off that they knew the fatalities and the babalities and the friendships and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I do have one very early memory of seeing Mortal Kombat 2. It's quite bizarre because my younger brother, who I love dearly, he was at school very, very, very young with Louis Amos, who is the son of Martin Amos, the very famous novelist, himself the son of Kingsley Amos. And I must have been nine, no older than that. And for some reason, Martin Amos had come to pick up my brother and Louis for a day out. And I just went with them. And because I was a little bit older, I was like 2 years older than them.
Right.
I was sat in the front of the car, unaware of who Martin Amos was, but also aware that sort of my parents were quite impressed by him. So he must be important and clever. And I remember just trying to make some adult conversation with this like impossibly famous writer. And he took us to the Queensway Ice Bar.
No way.
He was interested in Mortal Kombat 2. Mortal Kombat 2 had interested Martin Amos
right,
in some way.
Well, he loves arcades, doesn't he? He did a book on arcades in the 80s.
Yes, Simon, he did. And he tried very hard to get that out of circulation. And he's failed to do so. If you have any way of tracking this book down, I think it was republished recently. Do get it because it's a real sort of curate's egg. If that's the right phrase. I'm not sure. I should know. I'm an editor. It's a bizarre book.
Yeah, he does like tips and cheats, doesn't he, on how to beat Donkey Kong or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, but that's interspersed with sort of like sprawling 8,000 word essays on like what Caravaggio could have learned from, you know, Space Invaders. I don't remember.
Yeah,
a really, really bizarre mishmash. It doesn't feel like it was an easy birth.
Right, right, right. Wait, did you play Mortal Kombat with Martin Amos then?
No, there but for the grace of God. I mean, really, really close. We stood next to each other. Well, you know, Louis and my brother went off to involve themselves with childish things. And Martin and myself, meanwhile, just stood there considering the Mortal Kombat 2 machine for a while, you know, sort of working out what it meant for society, that sort of a thing. And I remember, yeah, just sort of watching people go up and sort of play it and him being sort of interested in this, in the hold that it appeared to have on young people.
Right.
And it definitely did. It really, really did. I mean, I remember there were like people who used to hang around arcades waiting to essentially jump in for you and be like, oh, do you want me to do this character's fatality for you? Because they were just addicted to doing fatalities. They sound sort of mad. But they were there. I remember the fatality junkies.
What an incredible story. Maybe that must have been the time he was writing London Fields around then. So, which is,
I'd like to think that I had an influence. Yes, I had an influence on him. That the time that he spent with me in the arcade, watching people, you know, fail to do Sub-Zero's spine rip fatality.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I've been fortunate this year to have the opportunity to speak to some game developers right in the first flushes of their success or shortly after they've had a great success with whatever their project has been. And I always think it's interesting to ask people about what effect that success is having on their lives. So in the next batch of clips, we're going to hear from Josh Wardle, the creator of Wordle, the game that was a huge phenomenon, of course, in 2022, sold to the New York Times. And in this clip, Josh is talking about what it was like to live through that storm, that circus, and how he came out the other side. Then we'll hear from Dan Vaquito, who, together with his partner, created a smash viral hit called Trombone Champ. Bit like Guitar Hero, except you're playing trombone. It's a very funny, very brilliant game. And Dan was working at Penguin Random House when the game came out, and he very quickly realized that his life had changed, his and his partner Jackie's lives had changed forever. And then lastly, a different kind of success. This is a much slower form. We're going to hear from Tarn Adams, one of the co-creators of Dwarf Fortress, a game that has been knocking around for the best part of two decades, but then which released formally on Steam last year, I think, or at the very tail end of 2022, and promptly sold best part of a million copies. And Tarn speaks very openly about what that was like. I'm sure people would be interested. You know, when you sold Wordle, it was a big news story. It was on all the radio programs over here and on the telly, and I'm sure it was in the US where you are too. What was it like to go through that? And you know, did the sort of money that you got from that change your life in any meaningful way?
That's an interesting question. I think that's so. My experience of Wordle building up in the days building up to the sale was actually not that enjoyable. It was deeply stressful. Like, I was in this weird spot where there was this, you know, viral game, for want of a better word, and that I'd set out not to commercialize in any way. And in fact, I was like quite principled about that. Like, I didn't want to show ads. And what I discovered was other people had no such scruples, right? Wordle knockoffs proliferated. And I didn't have any issue with the, you know, like Dawdle and Quaddle, people kind of riffing on the idea. Yeah. But there were some people who basically took the game and the name and just put it on the internet or an app and put ads next to it. And that felt really, really bad to me, which was something that I'm still processing, actually. It's like, I had said I didn't want to make any money from Wordle, and I was fine with that. But that over here, there were some people who decided that they wanted to make money off Wordle. It wasn't money I was going to make anyway, so I should have been okay with it. But there was something that felt deeply wrong about that. It left me in a position where it was kind of unclear what my path forward should be, you know, in terms of I was giving the game away for free. I didn't want to start paying a lawyer to, you know, issue cease and desists. I didn't want Wordle to become my full-time job. It has been this thing that I'd done for fun. And so the sale to the New York Times, part of it was to alleviate that pressure. It wasn't ecstatic, euphoric, I've sold this thing. It was more, this pressure has released and it's not something that I need to concern myself with anymore. And so for me personally, it was inevitably with something like Wordle, likely the most impactful thing I'll ever do in my life. I think there'll always be a question that I'll ask myself is, you know, what if I hadn't sold Wordle to New York Times? What if I'd continued to explore it on my own? And what I have to come back to in those moments is how I felt at that time. And I was, quite frankly, miserable. I was deeply unhappy. And I'm much happier now, post-Wordle. Yeah, that's been a really interesting experience to go through. In terms of the money, I think it hasn't changed how I live my life, or I will hope that it, and that I will hope that that will continue. I'm very keen for that not to be, for me not to be that kind of person. I think it's also been an experience. I'm interested in your take on this, actually, because like my experience, obviously Wordle was a hot new thing. Everyone wanted to talk to me, and it felt like what really was of value was me. I was giving something by talking to reporters, right? I was getting something in return. I was getting Wordle publicized, but I felt I didn't really need Wordle publicized, but they were getting the creator of Wordle talking on their show. And that really made me withdraw from that. And I've been very selective, I think, about the things that I've chosen to do. And it was just so striking to me how the expectation and the default behavior is that people want fame, for want of a better word, and trying to navigate that in a way that feels authentic to me has been, I try and explain it to my friends or you know, people that I meet, and I think it's not, they don't really understand why I wouldn't, you know, milk Wordle for all it's worth.
And I mean, this game is, it's like a trombone game. So it's like a trombone music game where you're supposed to play badly. I was thinking like, you know, how big can the audience be? Although I was, again, I was confident it was funny, but I thought that maybe people would just share clips and laugh at the clips versus actually like making the game itself popular, you know?
And how soon after that tweet did you realize, oh, this is different to like the things I've made before?
It was pretty obvious really fast. Like, the moment we hit publish on Steam, immediately like did a lot better than we thought it would. I had extremely realistic sales goals in mind, you know?
What were you expecting to sell?
I was thinking, also when I was making the game, it was all part-time stuff. Like I was working a full-time 9-to-5 and working on the game like just nights and weekends and stuff, which is very tiring and slow. So I always was kind of like aspiring to work on games full-time or be able to work on games full-time. So as part of like the mental calculus there, I was thinking like if Trombone Champ sold like $50,000 worth of sales, like over a full year, like 12 months, you know, I might start to run the numbers and see like how long, you know, I could milk savings other than that to try it full-time. Then I was like, you know, but if it makes like $100,000 in the course of a year, then it's obviously like something I should really consider, you know? And I don't want to get too specific into numbers, but like we blew past 50,000 pretty damn fast.
Yeah.
So like, and again, those were numbers I was expecting from like, you know, a year's worth of sales. Especially like, I feel like the first month there was just like so much publicity and a lot of attention. Yeah. It's pretty overwhelming. So it was really immediate. And sorry, I'm answering this one question too long, but
No, it's great. I mean, did you quit your 9-to-5 then? How long did that take for you to hand in your notice?
Yeah. Yep. I think maybe like it was 7 or 10 days after the game went live that I did it. And it was kind of a necessity. Like, it's something I wanted to do, but at the same time, especially that first week, we were getting so many emails and like so many questions. And it was just taking so much of my time, you know?
Right, right. Full-time tech support you became for your own game.
Yeah, I think one of the stupidest mistakes I made was thinking that when the game went live, I would have less to do. You know, I was like, okay, I'm working on the game a lot, but then once it's live, it's finished. And then I could just like take it easy.
Yeah.
But really, like, once it's actually in the hands of people, there's so much more work to do because, yeah, you get that tech support, as you mentioned. There's just like a constant stream of things that you should add and should do to the game. And when I launched it too, it was like only on PC, it wasn't even on Mac at the time. So I was like, okay, now I have to start the work of putting on another console. So there's just so much to do. So I really couldn't wait much longer to quit my full-time job just because I was going nuts.
Yeah, yeah. What was their reaction at your work when you said, I made this trombone game and now I'm off?
Pleasantly nice, actually. I think they were happy that it was a funny, good story.
Oh, that's good.
You know, surrounding me leaving. Because I was with that job for a while. Yeah. I was at that company for about 15 years.
What were you doing, can you say?
Yeah, web design for publishing, like in New York.
Okay.
Like a big publishing house.
Like book publishing?
Yeah, book publishing, yeah.
Okay, nice.
It's a pretty different world than games. But I think they liked it. I mean, a lot of people quit publishing and then they go to like Amazon, you know, or some other, can I swear? Well, on this podcast?
Yeah, of course you can, yeah.
Well, you know, they go to Amazon or some other bullshit job.
And yeah.
It's always kind of heartbreaking when someone that you work with leaves the job and like just works for some company that you don't like, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Particularly in the book industry, people don't like Amazon, do they?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, personally, I don't like Amazon because they're pretty evil, but like, especially in publishing, it's like, we had someone leave and go to Facebook and it was, you know, you say congratulations, but you're thinking it's like, oh man, it's like Facebook, come on. So I think they were just happy that it was like a good story and that it's a funny story to tell.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, I'd mentioned this game to like a bunch of my coworkers and my boss like years back, you know, because from start to finish, it took around like 4 years to finish. So I think like 2 years ago, I like, you know, shared the trailer, that first launch trailer. So people were aware that it existed, but
they knew what you were up to.
Yeah, to some degree, but I don't think they expected it to become, I don't think anyone expected it to become popular. Because again, like when you describe it verbally, it's like it's a trombone game. People are like, okay, that's a choice.
It was kind of surprising and not surprising in the sense that we had wish list numbers, right? That you could kind of just see growing and you can see, oh, this is actually going to do okay, probably, right? We had something like 800,000 wish lists when we launched.
Gosh.
And those were just growing over the years. There was never really a big spike where they grew. It just was a slow, ever since we announced and made the Steam page. You know, back in whenever it was 2019 or something like that, it's just been slowly growing. And we're like, well, how is this going to convert, you know? And it did well. It did well. I mean, you really have no idea. I mean, there's people, of course, put these charts up on these sort of game developer websites and so forth that say like, well, sometimes the conversion is, you know, 1% of your wish list will convert. Sometimes it's 250%. And you know, we ended up around, you know, I don't know what it would be, the 30% mark or 40 in the first week, which is what they're talking about. And
that's pretty good.
Right in the middle. And that's enough for us. Yeah, it's fine to be a normal game for once, you know?
I mean, it doesn't cost anything for someone to add a game to their wish list. It's so, you know, the 40% who actually then, when the game's out, decide to pay for it, that seems pretty good to me.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was more than we needed, so... We're still ecstatic over here.
Okay, so this is a slightly taboo question, but we happen to like be talking on a week when there have been lots of stories in the news about how much money the game has made in the last month, because the information, I suppose, because of the way Steam works, is somewhat public. Yeah, how do you feel about people having those discussions in public about something that most people consider quite a private matter?
Well, for us, because we were doing donations, we actually found it beneficial to post our monthly earnings, and we've been doing so for, you know, maybe 15 years.
Why did you do that?
It kind of lets people know how we're doing and that, you know, things aren't great when they aren't great, which is when you really need people to show up. And they did every single time. It's just kind of throwing yourself out there. And people can also kind of misinterpret the numbers because our numbers were all kind of pre-tax and split between two people. So people could kind of have an idea that it was more than they thought it was, and et cetera. But
all in all, it was fine. People could see the dips, and then people could also see the bumps during, say, Christmas time or a big launch of some version or other. And so it turned out well for us. And actually, over sitting on our forum right now 2 days ago, because that's when the money came in, we just put up one of these posts that was our numbers. And I mean, I could just read the last three entries. It says November, 14,000. December, 15,600. January, 7.2 million.
That's a pretty good January.
Yeah, they were like, oh, you all just did 38 years of donations in a month. I'm like, yep, that's how it turned out.
Wow. Yeah, I feel slightly icky just even asking the question, but I think it is interesting, you know, especially I've always been kind of interested in particularly indie game devs because, you know, the people making Call of Duty, like no one really questions their success. But if it's like a really small outfit, it feels like this stuff's a bit more scrutinized. So I appreciate you being honest, but it seems like you're very open anyway with your players and with the public about it.
Sure, yeah. And if it's both useful and not useful to other independent developers to have these discussions because like Dwarf Fortress is just not really a translatable case, right? I mean, it's just super unusual. But at the same time, just talking about it, like, oh yeah, the conversions actually kind of work how you expect and stuff like that. I mean, people derive a lot of benefit from that. Those discussions we certainly did leading up to this, knowing, you know, not just 800,000 wishlists, but what would 5,000 wishlists mean? Like, what does it actually mean? And you can have some sense of that, and that's kind of nice to kind of temper your expectations and prepare for the future.
One of my motivations for making this podcast has been to create a sort of oral history of taste, but also of people's memories of what video games have meant to them. It's something that I'm interested in a lot. I work as a writer of nonfiction books who's interested in history, and so I spend a lot of time listening to oral histories from decades past, and I know how valuable they can be. A topic that gets brought up a lot around video games is preservation, how we look after digital objects that can be quite ephemeral and can often disappear. You know, this issue has never been more prominent than at a time when, you know, games like Fortnite or Call of Duty Warzone have their maps come out for a year or whatever and then are replaced by something else. And, you know, this work that people have spent, you know, great chunks of their professional working life on just sort of disappears into the ether. How can we look after that? How can we protect it? For people who are interested in the development of the medium, all that kind of thing. The next two guests are interested in this work. We're going to hear from Kelsey Lewin. At the time I spoke to Kelsey, she was one of the co-directors of the Video Game History Foundation. She's subsequently moved on, but in this clip, she is discussing how she and her fellow workers at the foundation would encourage or help out companies that were trying to excavate or salvage part of their digital histories. And then we'll hear from Stella Wisdom, who works at the British Library, an institution that, of course, is dedicated to the preservation of information. Stella works on the digital preservation side of things. And Stella describes here how game developers can submit their work to be preserved by the library.
You mentioned a minute ago about how companies really only started valuing their back catalogue. I mean, quite recently, really. There weren't remasters or re-releases, even maybe much before the year 2000, I guess. And there's all these stories of, like, famous games from the 90s and the 80s, like the companies just having lost the code and things like that. Like, I don't know if it's true, but, you know, Panzer Dragoon Saga is a classic game worth hundreds of dollars, and apparently Sega just lost all the code. And then there's also stories, isn't there, of Nintendo wanting to re-release one of its games and ending up using a ROM that they got from the internet or something.
So now that we have, I'm going to be careful how I word this. Now that there are internal pieces of information floating around there on the internet. We know that they have a pretty robust archive system, and
right, yeah,
it's
yeah.
not. It's been migrated from so many computers and stuff that it is in no way complete, I'm sure, and I know they're likely missing stuff over there. But I'm gonna say that in particular is probably pretty unlikely.
Okay. Well, I think what's definitely true is that companies have not valued their history yes. and their culture.
Well, and they've lost all kinds of this stuff. Absolutely, like that part is very true.
But I mean, why do you think that is? Why do you think like games aren't always treated in this way where archivists think that they should preserve them? Why is it taking like essentially a charitable organization to do this work?
Yeah, I mean, the good news is it is starting to be taken a lot more seriously. The bad news is that it took capitalism to start
right.
making that really happen, you know? Like I said, there really just was not an economic reason to keep this stuff sorted and available in any way, even internally for these companies for a very long time, because there just was no sense that someday they would revisit it and bring it back into the world again. You know, they didn't know that there was going to be nostalgia for these games. They didn't know that they would become classics that people would, you know, want to play, or like how the technology would change over time. So there just was really no need to do that internally and to spend money on it. And I mean, you have to remember, like in the early 90s and stuff, storing data was expensive. There's a reason people even reused floppy disks, which
right.
weren't even that expensive, but would still get overwritten and used multiple times, is because storage in general was not a cheap thing. So I think that it just wasn't really valued for a very long time and wasn't really worth it for companies. I now know that a lot of companies, not all of them, but a pretty good amount of companies now have at least someone whose job that vaguely is, and then some companies do even better than that. EA has an entire archive team.
Oh, nice.
That handles everything. You know, they knock on people's cubicles and go, cough it up, hand it over, and, you know, we will keep all of this internally. So it's much easier from our perspective. I mean, obviously, a lot of these companies aren't going to be like, and here you go, you guys can look at all of this publicly. But from our perspective, it is so much easier to try to cross that hurdle than to worry about, you know, it not being saved at all. So at least if companies have started thinking about this, then it exists. It hasn't been lost.
It exists.
And we can kind of go from that, go from there, instead of from going from what we're dealing with right now for the early days, which is, does anyone have it? Does this exist? What do we have?
Yeah.
But that does bring me to something else that the foundation does sometimes, is that companies have lost their stuff, and particularly things like, you know, their original key art or box art or something.
Right.
We happen to have a halfway decent amount of that, and we've actually provided it back to companies in some cases.
Can you say which game? Or are you not allowed to do that?
Off the top of my head, the Doom re-release, the Doom 64 re-release.
Oh, right.
One that I'm sure they will not be happy with me saying, but I have not signed anything, is that we provided source code back to Disney for the Aladdin and Lion King release.
Oh, right. Just those minor IPs.
Yeah. They don't like that, but they never made me sign anything, so...
It is a bit difficult. I mean, you can start having kind of big questions of what's a video game or what's a book. And really, what we've been kind of looking at is some of these quite writerly interactive works that some people might want to call a book and other people might want to call a video game.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of hard to pin them down.
Do you have to approach the IP rights holders for that? So like if you wanted to put a game that was developed in the UK... Grand Theft Auto or something, you wouldn't be able to do that because of legal reasons, or could you ask?
Grand Theft Auto is probably not the type of game that would be under scope for UK legal deposit because we're kind of looking at kind of writerly and narrative content.
Okay. They might contest that. Some of the writers on that game might say, this is literature.
Maybe. And I have been aware of filmmakers that have been doing some interesting experiments with Grand Theft Auto. With the types of works that we have been looking at and that we're featuring in the library's digital storytelling exhibition, which is open at the moment and runs to the 15th of October this year, we have been, with the works that we've been collecting, we have been working with the creators and the publishers to collect them. So under UK legal deposits, it's the same. People often say, does the British Library collect a copy of every book? And we can do, but we've kind of we rely on publishers to send us copies of these books. So it's the same with digital. So it's kind of working with the publishers to collect these works. We have got a right to collect publications. So if we're treating what some people might define as a video game as a publication, then we would have a right to claim it. But because we're kind of trying to understand how to collect and curate and preserve these types of works, it's definitely more meaningful to work with the creators and do it with their support and permissions. It's very much a kind of collaborative and kind of very respectful partnership work at the moment.
That was so super interesting. So, I mean, you know, lots of people who work in the games industry listen to this show. If anyone is, you know, interested in getting in contact with the British Library to deposit their writing for games, is that something they can do? They can email you?
Yep, they can do. There is a legal deposit site on the British Library website, and that gives full details of how people can deposit their publications. So yes, do get in touch. We've also got a page for our emerging formats research, and I would imagine if it's someone in the kind of games industry with more experimental works, they would probably be best having a look at the emerging format page and contact them in that address. The game is on an interactive website, though. There is a nomination form for the UK Web Archive, so anyone can nominate a website. It's that's probably the best thing to do if something's on, like, say, a browser-based game.
Yeah.
And that's where we've had quite a lot of success collecting, actually, because of the technology for web archiving.
Something I'd like to do more of in 2024 is to have more developers on from other countries. One of my few guests from Japan this year was Tetsuya Mizuguchi, the creator of Rez, of course, an absolute classic that appeared on many of my guest lists, including that of Phil Fish, the winner of the Best Console of the Year, according to you, the listeners. Miz came on, and one of the things that I loved hearing him talk about was his first experience with a video game. He had a friend whose parents owned a toy shop, and because of that, he got to experience one of the very first home computer games to come to Japan. And once we've heard from Miz, we're going to hear from one of the creators of that game that Miz played, from Nolan Bushnell, the co-founder of Atari.
This is my first game I played.
Oh.
I think I was 10 or 11 years old kid, and I went to my friend's house, and I saw the Pong. And that was the first time, you know, some device connected to, you know, the TV, the house TV. And TV was color, but the game was black and white in my memory. So I don't know exactly, but in my memory, game was black and white. And that was the first interactive, you know, thing. Interactive thing, you know. That was the first time I encountered, you know, that kind of things and experience. I played Pong with my friend, you know, the moving controller.
Yeah, so you use a rotator dial, don't you, to move the bat back and forth, and it's a bit like tennis for anyone who's not seen it. But everyone knows what Pong is.
Yeah, but that was a very simple game, but it's so fun. And anyway, you know, first interactive experience, you know, for everybody. So, and sound is like very primitive sound, but it's very addictive. The game is pretty simple, but really addictive. And so everybody,
Did you go home from your friend's house and ask your parents if they would buy you Pong?
I think I did, but nothing happened. Nothing happened.
So is this your friend that you mentioned here? Because I know you had a friend who his parents owned a toy shop. Was that this friend?
Yes.
Oh, it was. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, his parents' shop, 80, you know, the new games, you know, technology, and the new game after Pong. So there was like, you know, toy box.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it was like a, gate and the door, you know, to the future, you know, all the time, you know. I love to visit his place.
I bet, yeah. That's a good friend to have when you're 10 years old.
Yeah.
And our idea was we were going to be a design house for the other companies.
Right.
Because we had no money and no factory and all that other stuff. But, and that's when Odyssey came along. And we thought, and Al needed a project to kind of train because we were going to do a driving game. And so I wanted to have something that was simple. And I defined the ping pong game, and it was very fun. Then it got funner and funner. We made modifications to it. And when we put it on location, it's the old story that it quit working because the coin box filled up, which was an easy problem to solve.
Yes. Yeah, so many people were pumping quarters in that they could no longer register a credit, could they? That's right. And they, yeah, like I say, with the name Pong, obviously from ping pong, but you got rid of the ping. So yeah, when did you come up with the title for the game?
Really, immediately upon deciding to market it.
And it Pong has, I think, one of the greatest instructions ever devised for a game, you know, video game or board game. Avoid missing ball for high score, just sort of enviably succinct. Where did that originate?
Well, I don't know. I think I just wrote it out on a piece of paper and handing the guys because you had to have instructions. You know, one of the fun stories is when we got a British distributor, he says, "You can't call it Pong here." And I said, "Well, why?" He says, "Well, Pong is a euphemism for a bad smell." I said, "Really?" He says, "Yeah." You go, "Ooh, there's a bit of a Pong in here." He says, "You know what you want? If you had a bar, would you want to have a machine over there that says fart?"
I think I'm glad that you didn't listen to that guy. I mean, okay, he makes a good point, but it's one of those things where I guess when you come out with the thing, people immediately forget the previous associations, right?
Well, actually, we changed. We marketed it in the UK as under Ping.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay, I think that's it. Had lots of other wonderful guests on this year, of course, and could have picked really hundreds of clips to play you. But we've got to draw a line somewhere. And if you'd like to go back and listen to the back catalogue, please do so. I think there's something in every single interview for you that's worth your time. I started this podcast at the end of January 2023, as I said in the intro. It's been just such a joyous thrill to make this. A lot of hard work, but also very, very rewarding. I've got a few thank yous I'd like to do. I haven't ever done this before on the podcast. This seemed like a good moment to do that. Firstly, I'd like to thank my friend Alex Barron, who I worked with closely at the New Yorker Radio Hour. Alex is a wonderful radio producer. We worked on 4 or 5 stories together over a period of a few years before he left WNYC to movies at the New York Times. Now, I learned a great deal from Alex. And in fact, Alex was responsible for producing a story we did about war games that later turned into my book, A Game of Birds and Wolves, which you might be interested in, all about wargaming in the Second World War. I got a lot to be thankful to Alex for, but especially for just, you know, encouraging me with a bit of presenting or whatever this is. And also, you know, for just being a kind supporter as well after this podcast came out. I'd also like to thank Dave James at the BBC. So yeah, My Perfect Console is something I've been thinking about doing for quite a long time and had a few meetings about perhaps collaborating with different existing media companies, one of which was the BBC. Dave works in development and was very kind. He spent like a few months working with me, just sort of drawing up proposals, how it could all work. And the idea did go a certain way within the BBC before a commissioner said, you know, it wasn't quite what they were looking for. Fair enough. I wanted to thank Dave for his time just
the time he spent thinking about this and what it could be and how with the shape of it, and for his encouragement as well. And thank you as well to Matthew Castle and Samuel Roberts, who you might know from the Back Page podcast, a very good and enjoyable podcast all about video games. Samuel and Matthew are two veteran video game magazine editors, working on the official Nintendo magazine and PC Gamer and things like that. And they have a fun podcast and been very supportive as well of me. Samuel, in particular, before I launched My Perfect Console, just sent a very long and helpful email of things to do and things not to do. And I was really grateful for that, and his encouragement helped get me over the line of starting this thing as well. So thank you to both of them. And if you've not listened to their podcast, you should absolutely go and do that. Yeah, so I told this story actually on my friend Steve Curran and Simon Byron have, I think, what is probably the world's longest running radio show about video games, that is One Life Left, that appears on Resonance FM. And I, when this podcast came out, they were good enough to invite me on, and I did tell this story. But yeah, I did have an email from a podcaster / radio production company a couple of years ago asking if I had any ideas, and I told them about this sort of thing that I'd like to do, and had a meeting with this sort of exec from Soho who is, energetic, let's say. He was encouraging, but he did say, how would I feel about perhaps being an executive producer and instead getting Peter Crouch, the ex-footballer and ubiquitous podcast host, to host the podcast, and which is a fine suggestion that I'm sure would have been a much more popular podcast than this one, but it wouldn't have quite maintained the tone and personality and perhaps expertise, is that okay to say? Knowledge, perhaps. Anyway, it just would have been a different thing, right? So thanks to them for maybe passing on the idea. Well, anyway, some of you have listened diligently, even without the great Peter Crouch being involved, and to you, I am especially thankful. So yeah, thanks for listening. Thanks for being so encouraging. Thank you to the hundreds of you who have written me emails to just either, encourage me or suggest guests who could come on. Many of you continue to do that every week. And I do have a huge long list of guests I'd like to get next year. And I'd certainly like to keep doing this show after that, into the year after that as well. But we'll see how we go. For now, yeah, thank you to listening. One of my other friends, Anne Scansbury, did mention to me, how come I never thank any of the other people who go into making this podcast? Well, that's actually because it's just me at the moment, so I don't have a producer or an editor to thank. Perhaps I get to collaborate with some people in 2024. We'll see how things go. Finally, thank you to Benjamin Drayton. He is a listener and who got in contact. He's also a radio producer and produces comedy podcasts like the Taskmaster podcast and other bits and pieces for Radio 4. And he very kindly has been helping me to improve some of the quality of the guests' audio. So hopefully in 2024, we'll have some things will be a little bit clearer. Try and do my best using my abilities and skills and the tools that are available to me. But Benjamin's been helping me to time that up as well. So thank you to him. Thanks again for listening. Looking forward to year two. That will be starting at the end of January 2024. So there'll be a little break of a couple of weeks and then we'll be back. Got some wonderful guests lined up. Really excited to share all of those conversations with you and to see where we go in 2024. All the best to you and your loved ones. Have a peaceful new year, start to the year. I think it's probably already begun by the time you're listening to this. And thanks again for your support. Onwards.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.